Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Show Talk with Angela Butler. I'm, of course, the host, the radio personality for Show Talk with Angela Butler. The interview on the show today is with Mr. James, Devin James, who is an author of the book Inside Ferguson, A Voice for the Voiceless. He's going to talk about his PR, I believe it's a PR firm, am I right?
Communications firm.
Yes, a communications firm, okay, where he and his team, his company, the Devin James Company, a firm, went in to help Ferguson, Missouri. And he's going to talk about Michael Brown Jr. All right. Hello. How are you doing, Devin?
How are you? I'm doing good.
Doing great. So, you were called into Ferguson before the death of Michael Brown Jr. Am I right?
Yeah, well, so my organization, the Devin James Group, we have been working in North County, which is basically the county that Ferguson, Missouri sits in. It's a predominantly black community. And so as one of the minority vendors in communications for, you know, the government sector, we have been working in that area doing, you know, community engagement work and research and other types of communication assignments.
Okay. All right. So while you were in Ferguson, what did you observe or witness? And also, do you live in Missouri?
I've been in Missouri. I lived in Missouri for about 6 years prior to the death of Michael Brown. So I was pretty familiar with the area. I lived on both sides of the river, actually, in the Metro East area, Edwardsville, as well as downtown St. Louis, and off of Natural Bridge. I've been in all kinds of different areas in St. Louis, so I know the area of the landscape pretty well. And, you know, basically what we were called in to do, again, you know, I wasn't working directly with the city of Ferguson. I was working with a county entity called the St. Louis Economic Partnership. And the county leaders are the ones who chose my firm to go in and assist the city of Ferguson with the outraged black community at that time. So, you know, a lot of people have, and this is partially the media's fault and, you know, partially propaganda, college tricks, as we call it, you know, but, you know, that was a misrepresentation that was intentional about what we were there to do. But there were two PR firms that were sent there to handle PR. My assignment was to handle community engagement.
Okay, so there were two PR firms in your firm, okay?
Yep.
So, during the time that you were there, did you witness racism? Oh, wait. No, I want to start with your left. I apologize. In the book, you said that you're Michael Brown. I'm Michael Brown. What do you mean by that in your book?
Well, you know, I think that you know, one of the things that a lot of people get when we talk about Michael Brown is they get sidetracked by his guilt or innocence of, you know, what happened before she was killed. You know what I mean? And I think that's a common distraction tool and character assassination tool that's used, you know. And what I'd like to do is to just use my life story to show people, you know, that Black Lives Matter. Because when you look at his life, you know, he was, you know, maybe he had got into some trouble or different other things or whatever, but he was going to school. This is a young Black man who's got a great future ahead of him, and that was taken away. And so, you know, what I say in my book about that is how many times I've been given a second, third, or fourth chance, and he didn't get one, and that's unfortunate, and that's what I think we need to focus on.
Okay. So, it gives me a little insight about Ferguson, Missouri. I know it's predominantly Black citizens there, but the attitude of the people, the beliefs of the people concerning the police.
Well, I think when it comes to the city of Ferguson, and it's not really just the city of Ferguson, it's the entire state of Missouri and St. Louis County, but there is a embedded institutional racism that just kind of flows through all the different parts of government there. But what we saw in Ferguson particularly was, you know, the element where, you know, a lot of people understand that institutional racism exists, but they don't understand it when they're in the middle of it or when they're a contributing factor to it. So what we saw was this cognitive dissonance whenever we would introduce the idea that, you know, hey, maybe you're part of the problem instead of everybody else. And so, you know, I think that's, you know, one of the ways that you can, you know, try, you know, one of the ways that we're also trying to educate people on what institutional racism is and how sometimes you can be a part of it without being conscious of it. You know what I mean? And then there are places where people were conscious of it. But again, I feel like, you know, there's a lot that can be learned from this. And that's why, you know, I encourage people to go to my website, www.insideferguson.com, to check out some of the things we have. You know, we're in the middle of developing some curriculum to talk about a lot of the different things that I encountered in my life experiences, as well as what we experienced in Ferguson that people can really learn from. And that's what I really hope that people get from the book is the learning experience that you can get from both sides of it.
Okay, so in your book, you talk about your life growing up and the way you were treated by the police. And you call your dad a hustler. Okay, I'm going to know, why did you say that? Why do you believe that?
Can you repeat the question again?
In your book, you talk about your life and how you got started and why you consider yourself Mike Brown. You called your dad a hustler, and later on you called yourself a hustler, but you're well-educated. So would you like to talk to the listening audience a background on you and your life? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. So you know, the background on the hustler piece, depending on whether you're talking about my dad or myself, is, you know, really what I'm talking about is taking an alternative route to a quality of life. You know what I mean? Because one of the things that constantly impressed upon us is that you have to take this linear approach to everything, and everything has to go this way. And so the education system drives down our growth that, you know, if we get this level, get this particular educational accomplishment, then we unlock this level of potential. If we get another level, you know, of educational attainment, we get this level of quality of life unlocked. Well, what I realized through my father and through my own life experiences is that, you know, when you're a Black man and when you encounter some of these labels like felony or different other things, you know, you have to be creative. And so in that creativity, you know, sometimes people are, you know, they refer to it as hustling or whatever. And it's really just, you know, finding and honing your entrepreneurial skills.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that. Okay. So that's where a hustle is. You're right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be associated with anything negative, or, you know what I mean? Like, hustling is just that go-getter mentality, that refusal to be defeated or labeled or suppressed by the labels or by the institutions. You know what I mean? It's that fight, that desire to, you know, to make do for yourself and your family, regardless of, you know, what opposition you have. And it's like there's a tenacity and a courage that's built in that. And I think that, you know, we need to recognize that especially in Black and communities of color, because it's an attribute that's not really valued.
Okay. So I was reading in your book, you said that there were some officers, police officers, who were wearing bracelets with the phrase, "I am Darren Wilson." How did that affect you?
Well, I mean, it's disheartening. Obviously, you know, we know that these type of mentalities exist, but, you know, when you're in a position where you have to work alongside it, I think it's troubling, you know? And I think many people discount how damaging it can be to your psyche and to your confidence and, you know, to your work life and experiences, you know, having to deal with that in the workplace. It's very tough.
Talking about racism.
Yeah. I mean, you know, having to deal with those blatant acts, you know, of expression, you know, because just to give an example, I mean, if you think about it, like, you know, I can't say Black Lives Matter or use certain Black hashtags or do certain things, you know, to empower Black people. But, you know, everybody wants me to be okay with these other affirmations. And so it's just, you know, it's kind of like a you know, another form of aggression that's taken, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
The lady that started Black Lives Matter, I believe her name was Blaine. Her last name was Blaine. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Go ahead.
They said she committed suicide in jail. The young lady that started Black Lives Matter. Could you say her name?
So I can't hear. I don't understand what you're saying. It sounded like you were talking about Sandra Bland, and then you switched gears, and you're talking about somebody else.
No, sir. I'm still talking about her. I'm talking about the lady that was with Black Lives Matter. That was they said she committed suicide in jail.
Okay.
My question is, did you ever meet her?
No, I didn't meet her.
Okay. All right. So basically, you were there in Ferguson. You and your company was to kind of straighten everything out, give a better perspective of everything.
No.
Am I right?
I'm not exactly. No. What our task was basically to assist both sides in being able to communicate effectively. Obviously, there was some tension, and, you know, there was an aggressor in a sense, and so our job was to go in and to try to create an opportunity for them to be able to communicate with each other. You know, the common dialogue that you hear is meaningful dialogue. Well, the only way we can really get to that is if someone takes the genuine initiative to go see how the victims feel and what their, you know, the terms people use were demands. But, you know, I really just try to use, like, you know, try to get a pulse of, you know, how do they feel about what happened and what do they think should transpire? Is it a leadership change? You know, do we need an apology? Do we need this? You know, what is involved in moving forward? And that's really what our firm was retained to do. And that's a lot different than what people think. You know, it's not like we're coming in and we're going to enforce this, we're going to say that, or we're trying to advocate for the government or interpret things a different way to trick people or anything like that. It's none of that. We're actually more so like a translator. And so I try to get people to understand, like, when you're using a translator, you don't get angry at the translator for them translating the message to you, right?
Right. That's right.
So
in your book, you talk about the media, how they didn't really show the 18-year-old that was killed, Michael Brown Jr.'s death, as a tragedy. You talk about that in your book. Do you believe this was deliberate, or it's just the way the media is, or what do you believe?
Well, I think that, you know, again, when you go back to the institutional racism and the implicit bias, it's prevalent all throughout the country, regardless of what industry you look in. If you look at insurance, if you look at the NBA, if you look all across the board in any genre that you want or any sector, you're going to see it. And so in the media, you know, we constantly see, you know, poor examples of black people. You know, we see misrepresentations of things that happen. You know, we constantly see statistics that are, you know, misreported or misrepresented or slighted to make it seem as though one community is doing things at a greater rate. And then when you actually go and do a little research, you find out that it's completely opposite or flip-sided. And you can't think that that is not intentional at this point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. Racism has been here been in America since black people were bought on the ships against their will. It's nothing new. The killings are nothing new. The media tried, at that time, was portraying like this was new, that unarmed black men were being killed. But most of the So most people, you know, so Michael Brown Jr., his death, of course, is a tragedy, and you feel that the media failed to show him as a human being, as a person, and that his, or rather that his death was a tragedy. Could you explain that?
Yeah, I think there, you know, again, I want people to, you know, to check out the book and obviously go to the website to get more, but basically I think one of the things that you got to understand is that there's an element of character assassination that goes on in these type of scenarios. So again, you know, when you continue to see this happen, you got to look across the board and see the pattern. So if there's a pattern, and it's systemic, it's not something that just happens on one or two occurrences. So I just encourage people to dig more into it and go to our website and learn more about it, www.insideferguson.com.
Okay, all right. So would you expand a little bit more on institutionalized racism?
Yeah, well,
from your point of view, for black people?
Yeah. Yeah, so institutional racism, it can come in a form of dress codes. It can come in a form of driving restrictions. I'll give you an example of driving around some neighborhoods. I was just in Atlanta, and I seen a sign that just, you know, in a certain area that I know that a lot of wealthy, you know, African-American people live in, and one of the signs talked about how you couldn't circle the block certain numbers of times within a certain time frame, or you would get this type of fine. You know, so institutional racism can come in all different kinds of forms, and it's used in different ways. So, you know, one of the things that you need to do is you need to become educated on it so you can see it. And then that'll also help you know when you're enforcing it too, because like I said, a lot of people enforce it and they don't even know it. So, you know, I just encourage people to read the book. You'll learn a little bit more about it. And then, like I said, if we get the opportunity to stay connected and you keep following, you'll learn more about it as we progress.
Okay. All right. Read the book. Okay. I understand. Okay. What was it like in Ferguson for you when Michael Brown Jr. was killed, and what? And if you can, talk about the officers, Darren Wilson, who shot him.
Well, you know, number one, I wasn't in Ferguson when he was shot. I was representing North County at that time, but I wasn't in Ferguson at that particular moment. What I expressed publicly on Twitter was my outrage and my disappointment and, you know, my raw emotions at that time. I spoke about that in the book. I'm a black man. I'm a father. I'm concerned. You know, I think that we need to do something to address the policies. And what I'm trying to do with the book and everything that I'm doing is take the conversations and turn them into legislative change. What we saw in Ferguson and what we saw with Darren Wilson and all the other officers who feel like their offenses against, you know, black people and people of color were justified is, you know, another example of, you know, basically the institutional racism and things that have been going on in this country for many, many years. Slavery didn't end. It basically just modified, you know, Jim Crow, all these different things. They didn't go away. They just became more institutionalized and like hidden in a way or disguised in a way, but sometimes they're wide open and right in your face. But, you know, that's the types of things that I'm trying to address, because I feel like if I can raise the consciousness of not only, you know, my white brothers and sisters, but, you know, my people and other people of color, then we can have these conversations that actually lead to legislative change instead of just being conversations that lead to, you know, another rally or just another person talking or another person angry or another hashtag. You know, we've got to have some economic and some legislative change in order to move this forward. And that's what I'm trying to address.
Okay, I understand it. Well said. So, then, even though you weren't there when Michael Brown Jr. was killed, you weren't in Ferguson. What was the reaction of the community? I mean, because Ferguson, Missouri is like 70% black, and I already know, and I'm sure the people listening know also, that there are hardly any blacks at that time on the police force. So what was the reaction of the people who talked to you?
I don't think you said the people who what?
Any people, were there any black people that talked to you about his death and how he laid on the ground 4 hours, his body?
Yeah, I think the consensus, you know, of everyone that I spoke with and the community at large, as well as around the country, was that it was, you know, very disrespectful to his remains, to him as a person, to his family, and to the community. That was across the board. I think that was evident by the unrest, you know, and all the commentary and things that went on. But, you know, one thing that we have to make sure that we're aware of is the fact that, you know, when you look at how government reacts to other things, and then you watch, you know, a person who goes into a church and does a mass shooting, and then they walk out and then they get taken to Burger King, like, you really get infuriated by what happens to any black person who commits a minor offense. You know, here's a person who didn't kill anybody, a person who allegedly robbed a store, because, you know, he didn't get his due process. He didn't get a chance to go to court. So, you know, we really shouldn't even be talking about any of that. It shouldn't be even on the table. But, you know, what we're dealing with is, you know, a situation where people refuse to see the humanity. They refuse to see Micah Brown as someone who could have been their son or what have you. And the end result is nobody should die from the hands of an officer. Especially for something like this, you know, if there's an altercation, you know, black men should be able to get arrested, not get beat the hell up or killed before, you know what I mean? And then you see, it's not even just black men. Look at Sandra Bland and many others. It's basically like an assault community and other communities of color. And that's why I say, like, you know, a lot of the things that have happened that, this is continued. It's not new. It's just, you know, we have been desensitized, and we need to increase our humanity and our consciousness, and we need to get back to doing what we can to improve social equity for everyone. And then social equity is so that it's fair across the board. You know, we're not experiencing that right now. And that's, to me, what the whole point of pushing the Black Lives Matter slogan and hashtag and phrase and all that is for, because, you know, I really want us to get on the same page and understand that if all lives matter to everyone, then, you know, you shouldn't have a problem with saying Black Lives Matter, and you shouldn't have a problem seeing that Black people shouldn't be killed for traffic stops. They shouldn't be killed for minor altercations.
I agree with you. I agree with everything you just said. Now, you mentioned that about Burger King. You're talking about, I believe he was 20 or 21-year-old male in Charlotte, South Carolina, who killed 9 people. And I read, mm-hmm. too, that they took him to Burger King to eat. Now, that is
right.
A disgrace. And he also believes that he's not guilty. So my understanding is that he doesn't feel like he did anything wrong because the people he killed were Black. That's the only understanding that I have of that. And as far as institutionalized racism, there are people and Black people in prison right now who are innocent, and I've interviewed Mr. Paul Cates from the Innocent Project, the NAACP president of Ferguson, Missouri. I've talked to Mr. Malik Shabazz, and also talked to Ms. Hazine, his assistant. Mr. Malik Shabazz was the former Panther leader, and he's also the creator of lawyers for Black Lives.
Right.
So, I hope I got that right. There's a serious, serious problem here in the United States of America, and it didn't just start. The criminal justice system, in my opinion, is just another form of segregation and slavery. It's always been that way, to be perfectly honest, but in the 80s is when it really got bad with because of drugs. And the criminal justice system today, right now, has way too many Black people in prison, too many Black people on probation. I mean, they've got too many young people in alternative ed. So to me, that's institutional racism. But you're right, Michael Brown Jr. did not get due process. He in the media, he was not seen as a person. Well, not necessarily as a person, but as a person. They made it sound like he was less than human. And I feel like they villainized him. And I agree with what you said about character assassination. And I've seen this played out in the media with Trayvon Martin while I'm in Florida. With Trayvon Martin, he was villainized. And I started to wonder, well, who's on trial?
Exactly.
Trayvon Martin or Zimmerman? And they said that means they have a good attorney. I don't agree with that. I don't agree that white people are being because they have good attorneys. I believe it's all racism. I also believe, and I don't know if you agree, I'm going to give you a chance to talk in a second, that the state attorney who are defending these people, I don't believe they really care. And I also want to ask you this. Do you believe that Black people, when they're in court, are those their peers on the jury? Because I don't agree, because usually there's not even one Black on there.
I have a felony, and I've had my fair share of battles with the court system, and I feel like there's definitely systemic abuse rooted in that I very rarely see us get, you know, treated fairly in the court system. If you were to look at, you know, just since 1972, you know, there was about 300,000 people in jail then. There's a little over 2 million now, 7 million on probation and parole. You know, so basically, you know, this appears to be, you know, one of the strategies or tactics to, you know, continue to enslave black men and people of color. So, you know, there's a lot of evidence to support everything that you and I are saying about how corrupt the system is. So, yeah, I definitely believe we don't necessarily get treated fairly, you know, and I believe that, you know, we're in a system that we're set up to fail.
Yes, yes, that's it right there, set up to fail. Now, President Obama is president, and I see discrimination with the way they treat the president of the United States of America. I mean, he has the highest office there is, and I watched from here in Florida, I watched him on TV, and he said, if he had had a son, Trayvon Martin, he would have looked a lot like Trayvon Martin.
Right.
You know, that's pretty much all he said, but you could tell it was hurt. It was bothering.
Right.
And now that we have a black president in second term, I hear black people saying that he didn't really do anything to help anybody, but I feel like he did his best. I really do. I feel like he did his best, and he didn't do no worse than the prior president.
Well, you know, I don't have any comment on Obama. You know, I did get a chance to meet him a few times before he became president, and I was at the Democratic Convention in Denver, and, you know, I supported his campaign. You know, I think that, you know, he definitely broke a milestone and you know, and made history and, you know, and things like that. But, you know, I feel like we as a people, we got a lot of work to do in this country. And I think that,
yeah,
he was a step forward, but, you know, we got to do more. And, you know, I think what we as a community do, what we do need to do is hold our leaders more accountable. You know, we need to push for them to represent us. When they get elected and when they get to their positions of power, because I feel like one of the things I experienced in Ferguson and, you know, I've been a government contractor in 22 states across this country. And one of the things that I feel like, you know, we don't do, is, you know, we don't have representation in the rooms that matter, that actually advocate for us. That's why I became a voice for the voiceless, because, you know, in all the meetings, in the decision-making meetings, all the people who were there who were of color were just black faces. They weren't there with the, you know, conviction, the pain, the anger, the frustration, or any of the stuff that was actually going on in the black community. And I think that's where there is a disconnect. We need that because, you know, and I need my community to understand that we have to have people like me on the inside to fight for us. We need the protests and everything that goes on outside, but we also need people inside. And I understand there's scrutiny that goes along with that, and you know, we need to have our vetting process, but we need to be able to keep the lines of communication open, because everybody who's on the inside is not one of them. And that's what I unveil in this book, and which is one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure that I got this out, so that people could really understand that, you know, I was in there fighting for them, you know, and unfortunately I was the only one. And I really believe that if there were more people that were truly fighting on the inside, we wouldn't be sitting in the same place 1 year later.
Yeah, that's true. And you're right about all that. There are not enough black people in the right offices, political and otherwise, to really make a difference and to represent us. So we have people in office still really don't count the lives of black people. That's my complete feeling. So in your book, I was reading where you talked about the different meetings you had and different things. I also read about your own life experiences with the police department. Do you believe that the department suggested with Attorney General at that time, Mr. Eric Holder, did you believe that Darren Wilson would be found guilty, Officer Darren Wilson? This is not, just your...
Yeah, I mean, I think me and every other black person in the country knew he wasn't going to be convicted. I don't think that was new information or anything. You know, I mean, I feel like everybody knew. I mean, this is business as usual for government. Stuff happens. Everybody denies what happened. We do a character assassination. Everybody buys it, or some people buy it. We offend a couple other people. And then we do a healing campaign. Everybody sees all the articles, and then next thing you know, everybody's forgotten about it until 1 year later or two, whenever, and then by that time, the media has switched gears, which is what you see now. You don't see the same coverage of, now that almost every city in this country is now standing up, and you see protests and demonstrations everywhere. It's like, okay, well, now we didn't really want to cover all that. We just wanted to make our ratings and get our money off our ad equivalency, and then we're on to the next thing. And I think that's really what you're seeing that happens. It's part of how this is kind of desensitized for us.
Yes, I believe we as people have been desensitized, and I think a lot of it comes from television, internet, even some music. I mean, the media, radio. I mean, become, I believe, like, oh, we see this all the time. You know, there's not any real compassion because we've been desensitized. I'll even take it a step further and say that some people have been brainwashed.
Yep.
So one of the things you kept saying over and over in your book Inside Its Purpose, A Voice for the Voiceless, that Michael Brown Jr.'s death was a tragedy. Said it numerous times. And I would like for you to expand on that, please.
Sure. I think about how heartbroken some people are when one of our beloved sports figures hurts themselves on TV. And I see how Twitter and everything erupts, and they say, oh my God, I hope that person's okay, and all of this and that. But then, you see an 18-year-old get killed and get laid in the street like a dog, and you don't care just because of what color that person is. And that's wrong. And it breaks my heart. And I feel like, you can't say we're surprised when you think about 400 years of abuse and things of that nature. But what you say is, when you have so many people around you, and, I'm sure like you, you've got, white brothers and sisters that you may call friends and family and stuff like that, too. But, when instances like this happen, sometimes you get to see people's true colors. And sometimes you're surprised at some of the people that you have around you. And I think, with the death of Mike Brown, for me, working with some of the firms that I worked with over the years and some of the leaders that I worked with over the years, it was personally disappointing. It was emotionally disturbing how insensitive some of the people that I had to work with daily were.
Yeah. My belief is not all of the United States, America, not every white person here is racist, but I also believe that the majority of the United States of America is. And that majority, I believe at times, silence those who aren't as racist or racist at all, because of the majority.
Yeah, I understand. And when you think about it, there's so many different forms of racism, and what I talk about in the book in terms of, like, you know, white fragility and just, you know, sometimes you have to be careful how you approach, you know, the subject of racism when you're talking to certain people, because, you know, it's almost like a fight or flight response to it, and that, you know, it's a difficult topic to have, and people don't want to accept that they are, you know, or that they have fainted or been racist or made racist or discriminatory comments and things of that nature. So I think with the book, many people will, you know, especially if they take the time to truly understand it and not, you know, try to jump to one side or the other, black or white, or pro Mike Brown, pro Darren Wilson. But if they just kind of dig into it to understand, they may be enlightened that they have participated in a lot of things that have discriminated and inflicted a lot of pain and hurt on other people.
Yes, that is very true. And the rioting, I believe, that went on in Ferguson, Missouri after the death of Michael Brown Jr. was because of mistreatment, abuse, underrepresentation, and anger. Anger at happening. And people just got tired. That's what I believe. I mean, I understand that violence doesn't seem necessary at times. But those, the people there were venting out their frustrations. I mean, they're people, they're human beings who did those things. They were the same, might have possibly been some of the same people who the police had abused.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand the rioting to me means that they're being heard. They want to be heard.
Exactly. And you know, I tell people all the time, I'm 100% I just want us to have more economic impact, because, like, when you look at the movements in the 60s and everything, you know, what you see is you see protests in combination with economic impact. You see a boycott. You see something that, you know, we've got to understand the power of our black dollar.
Yeah.
And if we can harness that power, and if you're being mistreated, you know, it's just like, it's as simple as this thought process here with, you know, you don't spend money at restaurants that serve you food that you don't like and that are disrespectful to you and how they serve you. So stop spending your money. Get off their buses. Get out of their programs. Get out of their schools. You know what I mean? Get out of their systems and pull your money out of their banks and then see what happens. I guarantee we'll get their attention. It's worked in the past, but again, the protests have never been without some type of economic impact. So that's what we got to do. You know, in addition to just, you know, marching and on, you know, we have to have it in combination with the black dollar. So, I really believe that if we work together, we can get some things done. But, you know, if that's going to take some time, then I encourage the black community and communities that support them to empower black businesses and black people. You know, if there is an assault on black people and all lives matter to you, then go support Black Lives Matter. You know, because black would be included in all.
Okay, that's right. So you keep referring to Black Lives Matter. The young lady that was said to have killed herself in jail, I think a traffic stop or something. I personally,
that's Sandra Bland.
Yes, Miss Angela Bland. What is your input on that and about Black Lives Matter? Because I believe, isn't she the one who started Black Lives Matter?
No, she's not the founder of Black Lives Matter. There's actually about three people who founded Black Lives Matter. I can get their names, but no, Sandra Bland, I believe, was murdered, just like I believe Mike Brown was murdered, and I, you know, I think that this is, again, the perpetuation of the same lynching type of stuff that's been going on in this country. If you stand up against them, you either face some form of retaliation or death or character assassination or something. This is common. This is American history.
Yes, it is. Very much so. You are 100% correct. 100%. And it's horrible. But like I said, it's nothing new. This has been going on since Black people were kidnapped and forced over here in the slave ship. And that's another thing I like to talk to you about. Black people, when they first came, were brought over here against their will. You understand what I'm saying? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep listening. The Black people were brought over here against their will and segregated. But none of that has ever made any sense to me. Because I feel like if you don't want us in this country, then you shouldn't buy ancestors over here against their will. I know I've heard people on TV say and different interviews say with me that we need to have our own things. They ain't necessarily our own country, but our own things. You know, spend more money with Black businesses and buy more books from Black authors and positive, you know. I've heard that said, but again, the continent Africa is where most of Black people's ancestors are from. We, or our ancestors, had our entire continent. And I'm not trying to say it won't work, but I personally don't believe that even if Black people started their own things, that some kind of way they other races will try to come in and take over. That's my firm belief. And that's the movement, well, not necessarily a movement, that's the wrong choice of words, but some people really believe separation.
Well, here's what I'm going to say to that. I just want to, you know, this is just me. I was looking at Twitter today, and somebody posted something I thought was really, really awesome. It said, hip-hop is Black when crime happens, but when it wins an award, it's everyone's culture. And I think that's exactly, like, where I feel like you're going, is that, like, you know, we're good when we're good to be used for whatever we're used for, but when it's outside of that, we don't really have any value to you. And I think that's, you know, one of the big themes that my book addresses, and that's what I truly believe that Black Lives Matter is about, because, you know, our lives should matter across the board like everyone else's. I mean, and we can extend that conversation to many different extensions, but, you know, it's just, if we just stay at the core of it, you know, it's just basically like, stop exploiting us.
Yeah, that's what the media is doing. Exploiting for ratings or whatever, and that's why it's called institutional racism, because it's in every area of work. Some kind of way, whether people realize it or not, racism affects their lives, even if they don't know it, in all areas, from work to school, criminal justice system, the pipes. The school, the pipeline to jail, all that even the school system. So in every, just about every Black person's life, racism, some of them don't even know that it's affecting them. Institutionalized racism is everywhere. And you're right, slavery did not go away. They just turned it around. in another way.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Michael Brown Jr.'s family, I saw on TV, his parents went to the Hague Convention, if I'm not mistaken. What do you feel about that? What is your opinion on that, on his parents?
Well, you said they went to what convention?
Hague Convention.
The Hague?
It's a convention where you go and address people, address different nations about crimes against humanity.
Oh, okay. Awesome. Yeah, no, I don't have an opinion about, you know, I think what I've witnessed of the Brown family is that, you know, they've demonstrated tremendous courage and you know, as I've said many times before, my condolences to them. And, you know, I truly believe that, you know, they're trying to advance the conversation on, you know, why this shouldn't continue to happen and why not just Black people, but everybody should stand up and be opposed to it. So I really commend them and any of their efforts to, you know, to eradicate racism and to educate people, because I think what they do is they give you, you know, because they're family, they give you more of a human, you know, feel, you know, the empathy, you know, like, I feel like people can connect more to a mother and a father who've lost their child. And sometimes, you know, instead of that, you know, the people who are just, you know, speaking about it, third person and stuff like that, you know, for me, as I've traveled around the country and met the other family members of victims of police brutality, you know, what I found is that they just all have this tremendous strength. And I just, like I said, I think it comes from, you know, just that Black pride. Like we've been a strong people for so long. I feel like we have it in us to endure. And what we see today is just, we're tired. The unrest, I think,
yes,
is reflective of us just being tired of being punished and being mistreated and being abused. And I think it's important for the families to come up. But honestly, I wish that we didn't have more families to add to that list. I wish we didn't have more hashtags and we can get past this particular era, you know. But, you know, we got work to do. And I'm trying to be a part of that conversation and a part of that change. I'm trying to get it to move from conversations to legislative action. And I feel like, you know, the more and more all of us do, respectively, the more we'll accomplish it, you know, advancing. I mean, and it started with Martin Luther's dream, and we're, you know, we're still dreaming, and we're putting action to the dream, and, you know, but it's going to take all of us, and that's why I feel like, you know, we need them out there telling their story as well.
Yeah, and I have to correct myself. It was not the Hague United Nations, so I'm sorry about that. Where his parents I'm sorry, everyone listening, that was incorrect. It was the United Nations.
Yeah, no worries.
Okay. One of the things that you talk about in your book, and everybody, you really need to get this book. So I'm just gonna go ahead and tell you. Mr. Devin James, his book, Inside Ferguson, A Voice for the Voiceless. It's really a book that will let you know what's going on, and it will enlighten you. I mean, some people just throw their prejudice and go on, but I believe that's because they have been desensitized. Were you there when there was tear gas put on the people there that were demonstrating and things?
Yeah, I was there, you know, witnessed a lot of people get pepper sprayed, tear gas, shot with rubber bullets, had dogs, you know, chasing them and threatened at gunpoint, billy club point, fist point, all kinds of ridiculous tactics that were used. So yeah, it was, you know, it was it definitely felt like we were in combat somewhere.
Yes, it's supposed to seem like most of the police departments have made war with their own citizens, particularly their black citizens or their brown citizens.
There were a lot of people that suggested it was the first step toward martial law.
Say that again, please.
So there was a lot of people that were suggesting that it was a test or a first step towards martial law. You know, definitely the increased military presence and the military equipment that was used. You know, I think that, you know, a lot of people in the community feel like it was like us against them.
Yes, yes. And yeah, the citizens are having to defend themselves against the very people who are supposed to serve and protect them.
Right.
They have to be afraid of the people who are getting paid with their tax money, with their probation money, that they pay for probation, and businesses and things. I mean, you know, this plan is wrong. It's all wrong. The very people who are, their taxes are paying are hurting them and have literally, to me, made war with black people, me included. I mean, that's the way I see it. They've made war with their own citizens, particularly their black and brown citizens, the police.
Yeah, you know, and I encourage readers to check out the book because, like, I talk a lot about, like, how, you know, and I'm sure you saw when you were reading certain chapters, how, like, certain language was used to describe, you know, protesters and you know, residents and particularly white residents versus black residents and different things like that. So there was all kinds of code language that was used, you know, to differentiate people. And I think that, you know, supports that argument about us versus them in a sense. So, yeah, I definitely encourage people to check that out. And you know, the other thing is I dedicated this book to people who were victimized. Too many names. There's too many names. I wish that the list wouldn't keep growing. But, you know, I really want people to understand what we went through, what I went through, and you know, how ugly this stuff is on the inside. Because, like, I feel like we don't get a chance to really see it. You know, we don't get a chance to see the internal communication. And in this entire book, you know, it's part autobiography, but, you know, it's history, you know, because we give you the backstory of all the headlines that you saw, you know, when you were watching on TV or when you were reading in the newspapers, you know, you just see the headline and whatever is approved. And so we basically, you know, I structured this book, and I give you, you know, the background to each of those, you know, using that chronological timeline, I give you the background to all the events and things that happen behind the scenes and the communications. And I think that gives the reader a really good view of how, you know, unimportant black lives are in the decision.
Devin, you got about 15 seconds. I thank you for coming on Show Talk with Angela Butler. I encourage people to go out Inside Ferguson, A Voice for the Voiceless. So I thank you for coming on Show Talk with Angela Butler.
Thank you. Thank you. Once again, go to www.insideferguson.com to stay in the know.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. You're doing a great thing.
Thank you for having me.
We need more people like you on the inside.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming on the show.